Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to increase major planned and principal giving. QBAC acts as a force multiplier for fundraisers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with prospects and cultivating them into lifelong donors. QBAC automates the qualification process beyond simple scoring to ensure that your fundraisers have the best prospects. QBAC also uncovers actionable insights about current and future prospects to help fundraisers develop personalized cultivation strategies. Start closing bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Also, how about being our next host for the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow? I'm looking forward to two things this summer: getting back to the ballpark with my kids and getting the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow back on the calendar. If your organization would like to be a host location, let's schedule a time to chat. The Responsive Fundraising Roadshow provides 6 hours of the best fundraising training out there based on Responsive's 4 sense-making tools. Hosting Responsive's Roadshow is not like hosting a major conference that requires months of planning and all types of resources. All we need you to do is provide us with a safe learning environment for 25 adult professionals in your community who want to understand how highly effective fundraising really works. There is no cost to your organization, and we will reimburse you for all related expenses. If your organization would like to host the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow in your community, reach out and let's have a conversation today.
Hi, Wendy. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. I have a sense of where this, I have a guess at the direction of where this conversation is going to go. But as most of my listeners and you perhaps know, we don't necessarily require our guests to come on having prefaced what we're going to talk about. So we're going to leave that up to you. But before you pull the cat out of the bag, as we might say, how about we just ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Great. Thank you, Jason. So glad to be on your show. I am Wendy Wilsker. I am managing partner of Boyden Executive Search. I am have recently opened the Boston office, and we are serving the nonprofit sector. I have devoted my entire professional career to serving nonprofits, and I've been in a variety of fundraising roles. Like many of our colleagues, I started my career as a student caller at my college's annual fund. I was at Syracuse University. I needed a job, and someone told me you could get free long-distance calling time at this job in the basement of a building. And I had a boyfriend who went to college out of state, and it was like the perfect job. And I loved it. I loved talking to alumni and parents, and I had no problem asking people for money. So a couple of years after I graduated college and had an unsuccessful attempt at working in advertising, I found my way into development. And my first real job in development was at the Jewish Federation of Greater Boston. And I spent 5 years at Combined Jewish Philanthropies and learned everything from volunteer management to donor engagement to cultivation, all of the moves management stages, and grew in my leadership and my responsibilities, and ultimately was managing one of their divisions. And since then, I have served in a variety of sectors. I have led institutional advancement at an independent school. I served as director of development at Leahy Hospital. I was most recently chief advancement officer at a social service agency. I spent a little bit of time as a consultant, and also spent 4 years working at Lindauer Global, where I learned the business of executive search. And one of the things that I found, Jason, is that executive search is so much like major gift fundraising, is connecting people's mission and values and purpose with great organizations. And that's really what's brought me back to executive search after 7 years building a very relationship-driven development program. I really wanted to serve the nonprofit sector in a way that I could help to advance leadership, advance talent, and ultimately advance missions of organizations.
So, Wendy, I have before I ask you to what we're going to take this conversation, I have to take advantage of the fact that I'm talking to a search consultant. I'm a baseball guy, and so I've always appreciated search firms that take the posture of like a scout. Mm-hmm. You know, like we have scouts who basically search out really talented people who know how to play baseball. And I don't know that the fundraising space, I don't know if the people, the more represented brands in the executive search space that serve the nonprofit sector and fundraising in particular necessarily approach it that way. Do you follow what I'm saying?
I do, you know, and I think it's a scout, or in my work as a major gift officer, I needed to really understand what made donors tick. What was important to someone? What did they care about?
Yeah.
What was the difference that they wanted to make in the world? And as I began to uncover that, I was able to make those connections. But quite frankly, it was a long-term process, right? It was getting to know someone. It was building trust. It was building relationships. It was staying for the long course and stewarding those relationships. And that's one of the things that I'm excited to bring to executive search, is that when we're working with candidates, I might talk to 100 people for a search. Only one person is going to get the job. I want to stay in touch with those other 99 people because I'm meeting fabulous people. And, you know, I want to cultivate and steward those relationships. So if that's going to set us apart a little bit, I'm going to lean on those principles that I enjoyed the most in major gifts work, and I think ultimately made me successful as a fundraiser.
So I'm very excited. Like I said, when we got started, I'm excited to be talking to you today, because this, anybody who's in sort of the search space in the midst of sort of what we're, I think somebody has termed it the great resignation on the back end of this pandemic, we're seeing lots of movement. So I have to imagine you've got some opinions about that. We ask our guests to come with a big idea or bold opinion. What do you got for us?
So you took the words right out of my mouth. There's two things, right? There's the great resignation. And as we're coming out of the pandemic, organizations that have had hiring freezes are lifting the hiring freezes, right? So there's going to be a lot of hiring and a lot of movement, right? My big idea is retention, right? And how do we change what has plagued the culture of nonprofit organizations of this 18 to maybe 24 month tenure? And if organizations, you know, resources are limited, right? And I don't think that nonprofit organizations can anymore afford the turnover. So as organizations and as nonprofits across the sector are hiring, what do they need to do to retain their staffs? So that's my topic.
Yeah. So let's just sort of cut to the chase. You're in the business of moving those people around, though. So how does a shop like yours sort of, how do you do that? How does an executive search firm who's in the business of basically making that movement happen in many cases, how does a shop like yours ensure that these people are actually staying put?
Right.
Because, you know, if I'm employing a team of major gifts officers, I don't know that I want them to know who Wendy is.
Well, I have often, when I was at JFNCS, I told my team not to answer if anyone from Lindauer called. So,
Exactly.
So, you know, a couple of things. I mean, we do get under the hood with our clients and with candidates, and we want to build teams, right? So the time that we take in the beginning of the search to really work with organizations to understand, where are you at in the evolution of your development program? What's your culture? What's your pace? What's your strategic plan? Where are you going? And then as we're talking to candidates, we're getting beyond, what are your metrics, right? Okay, so you raise X million dollars and you have X number of visits if we're talking about frontline fundraisers. But we want to understand, what is their approach? And, you know, do you have a connection to the mission of this organization? And so our goal is to hire people who are going to stick around and grow, Our goal is to work and develop long-term relationships with organizations so that we can build their teams. I mean, maybe I'll put myself out of business, but I think that there will always be movement, right? There will always be someone who has just reached a peak at an organization and is ready to go on to another organization. There will always be retirement. There will always be movement. But I think that hiring managers really need to think about how do they need to manage differently? And I think that the pandemic taught managers that you need to care. You need to cross that boundary of, you know, here we are, we're in each other's homes and everyone has seen each other's dogs, cats, and kids, right? I think that employees have always been looking for their managers to care about them a little bit more, right? To understand someone is not just showing up. There's more to someone than just how many visits have you had, right? And so how are we being flexible? How are we getting to know people and understanding what is important to our employees and understanding that we can manage them a little bit differently? So I think that leadership has become a little bit more human, a little bit more humble. And I think that is going to be something that may inspire people to stay. It's all about culture, right? It is all about someone saying, I love where I'm working, so that when Wendy Wilsker from Boyden calls, they're going to say, you know what, Wendy, thanks for the call, but I'm really happy where I am. I love my boss. I love the organization. I'm challenged and I see a growth plan for myself. If folks don't have that, then they are going to answer my call or anyone else's call.
Is it true in your mind that I think I've said this a number of times. I don't know that I've said this on the podcast, but I've said this in my seminars a number of times. I know that the salary for compensation, for example, that's oftentimes negotiated, and there's a lot of chatter about that and whether we're compensating men and women sort of equitably and so forth and so forth. But I think that's what people, I think that's what compels people to get the job. But I think we mistakenly sort of miss the point that that's not actually why people leave.
I agree.
Like, there's a reason why they come in the front door, and that might be the appeal of a really great salary, but that's not why they stay. It's not why they ultimately stay, because a lot of times those same dollars are available down the street. I mean, fundraising's become something that's quite competitive. And ultimately, when they leave, sometimes they'll even sort of forego with the next job, if they've already sort of made it up to the next notch, they'll even forego some of that higher expectation of compensation just to be in a place where they can thrive.
I agree. You know, people who work in nonprofits are not necessarily motivated by a paycheck. I mean, you have to pay your bills. You have to put your kids through college. You want to go on a few nice vacations. I was just speaking with a colleague this morning who's a consultant, and a client wanted to talk about retention incentives. And it just brought up this really interesting conversation, because I agree. I don't think it's the money. What do I think is really important that's going to keep someone? I would say to an organization, invest in professional development. Invest in hiring coaches for your high-performing employees to get them to the next level. And if you see someone with potential who's struggling, hire a coach for them. Help grow your employees. Provide those opportunities that is going to keep someone at your organization. I think people are motivated by mission, and I think people are motivated by leaders and the opportunity to be seen. One of the things that I was able to do, and I was at a mid-sized nonprofit, we were $25 million. I was on the senior management team. There wasn't a huge hierarchy, but I always felt that it was important that my major gift officers had access to the CEO, that if it was time to introduce a donor to the CEO, they were going to do that briefing. They were going to go on a visit with the CEO. And what always happened was the CEO would come back and say, oh my gosh, Wendy, they're amazing. And I would give that feedback to the gift officer, and it made their day, right? Being seen, access to board members. I think very often fundraisers are discouraged if they've been cultivating a donor for years and all of a sudden they make a 6 or 7 figure gift and that donor is taken out of their portfolio. Or all of a sudden a donor becomes a board member and they're taken out of a gift officer's portfolio. I think there's some negativity, you know, that goes on with that growth. And if you allow your fundraisers to continue to have that access and grow their donors, I think that is a retention strategy. You know, the other thing that I've been thinking about is we put such emphasis on treating our donors so well and doing all of these special things for our donors. What if we treated our employees the same way that we treated our major donors, right? Because at the end of the day, the value of those gift officers is just like the value of a major gift. And what would happen if leadership and managers thought a little bit differently like that?
Yeah, I remember it. So in my first book, I wrote about what they talk about in the healthcare. So the healthcare world knows that the quality of care that's given to a patient ultimately is a reflection of the quality of relationship that the nursing staff has with the hospital. And so if you can retain good nurses and you can retain them for a long time, you can ultimately sort of, it's an indirect way to know that patient care is working by taking care of your nurses. And I don't know why that has never sort of clicked in our space, that we're so damn focused on taking care of the donor and the donor's always right and da 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 da. But if we really just learned how to take care of our fundraisers and made them feel like they actually matter and that they're not sort of just existing in what I call an intervening sort of subculture, we sort of push them off into a corner of the organization that we don't have to deal with. I mean, on some college campuses, advancement is literally on a different part of the, you know, from everything else. I mean, aren't we basically talking about being integrated inside the organization?
Well, we are 100%. And it was either a guest that you had or some other podcast that I was listening to, but that was saying, how come retention is not something that CEOs are evaluated on, you know, as part of the annual
evaluate. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And how does that become a value?
Yeah, I know we've talked about that.
Yep. Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it should all be integrated, right? Because your fundraisers have to be part of the ecosystem of your organization. They're storytellers. And having that kind of access to students, to faculty, to being able to share the stories, that is what motivates people, right? Whenever I was having a bad day, all I had to do was to go downstairs if there was a Parkinson's dance program or if there was another program taking place, right? And I got so re-energized by seeing the work that we were doing. And I think when you have your fundraisers in different places, they don't see, right, the outcome of the dollars that they're raising money for. And I think that access and the opportunities to be involved in the organization are so important as well.
So one of the things that I routinely encounter, because we do a little bit of, we don't actually do search work at Responsive, but we oftentimes advise our clients on the fact that they're perhaps going to, because they're inevitably after working with a shop like ours, they're going to eventually hire someone. And one of the things that I typically run into, and you sort of alluded to this a minute ago, and I'd really like you to unravel the thought, because I mean, I remember a client I worked with in Wisconsin for quite some time, and it's that notion of sort of building longevity into the contract. Mm-hmm. And so I think we had picked it up. This is probably language that you all, you know, firms like yours sort of come up with and build these things, but it's basically, it was a longevity bonus sort of structure that incentivized, in this case, it was the executive director, not even the fundraiser, because the shop was investing significantly in their fundraising capacity. And I impressed upon the board. I said, look, if you're going to basically turn this guy into a more externally focused fundraising CEO, you're going to also have to ensure this guy sticks around for a while. And so here's an institution that had historically, I don't think they had negotiated more than 2-year contracts. And now they're learning how to write 5-year contracts, and not only writing 5-year contracts, but incentivizing him to stick around and providing a significant bonus on the back end. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately in this organization, in the 5 years that we worked through, 3 years that we worked with them, and then the subsequent years as we tracked their fundraising performance, I mean, they did some remarkably amazing things in terms of fundraising, but it's because that CEO stuck around.
Right. You know, I think it's really interesting. And I wonder, are we going to see more of that, right? I think it's a little bit the exception than the norm. I think at the CEO level, it's one thing. And I think sometimes those incentives, you know, are part of contracts or, you know, the years or what have you. And I think it's so important. I think the question also becomes, okay, then do you go down to your chief development officer? And what do you need to be doing to incentivize? And, you know, as you said before, is the incentive money? What are the incentives that will keep someone stay? And, you know, maybe it's not the same thing for every person. You know, I've heard on your podcast, you have four kids. I have four kids. Boy, I wish I could parent all of them the same, right? But they're not. And so I think that in your team, you know, how do you really understand what someone needs as they're growing? You know, I'm not quite sure that nonprofits are at that sophisticated level, maybe some are, of having career paths, of having those talent management conversations and the tracking and identifying the rising stars and creating those management tracks and professional opportunities. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, I think we have to look at what are some very good practices that have kept CEOs in their roles and for-profit or not for-profit, and really what can we adapt from the for-profit sector that will make sense for someone who's there because they're so mission-driven. You know, I know some of the things that I had done, people had asked to go on conferences, and monies are limited at nonprofits. We partnered with a small professional college outside of Boston that was training people how to be coaches and organizational development. And as part of their fellowship, they had to have on-site coaching. And so we hired some of those coaches, and it was a great experience for my team. So I think we have to look at it at all levels. And I would argue as well in development, you want to hang on to your gift processors and your operations person people because they know the stories behind the stories, right? So how do you create a culture, right, that is appreciating people at all levels so that you are eliminating some of that turnover and also creating some great career tracks?
You know, it's interesting to sort of read in between the lines, to listen in between the lines of what you're saying, because you're doing, you started a few minutes ago with, well, we started with longevity, and for a few minutes, we've repeatedly sort of talked about the idea of professional development. But at Responsive, one of the things that we constantly are saying to audiences, and I say this on here occasionally, is that fundraising in a lot of these organizations isn't, the problems that they encounter are not actually about fundraising per se. And I think a lot of times we're hiring these people because we think, because we're so damn focused on fundraising and what their fundraising skills are. But what we don't understand is that if you invest in professional development, and if you understand concepts such as organizational design, creating that culture like you're describing, where people can actually thrive, which is oftentimes those places where you can hire those young rising stars to sort of take off. I mean, so much of what I hear, and I hear this from my guest, and I certainly hear this when we're not, you know, when the recording button's not being pushed, you know, people are moving around, and a lot of reasons is because the hiring is so darn focused on the fundraising, and it's not focused on these other components that you're talking about.
I think you're right. And I've had a lot of conversations about how are you looking at the whole picture of who someone is, right? Yeah. I think a lot about what's inside, right? What are those soft skills that can't be taught and what can be taught, right? You can learn about an organization. You can learn planned giving, you know, those kind of the technical aspects, right? You can learn the technical aspects of the work, but you cannot teach someone how to connect with another person. You can't teach someone how to be curious. You can't teach hustle, right? You're going to bring on someone who you need to be a road warrior gift officer to do discovery calls and to make those connections. I don't think you can teach that. So when you look at someone's resume, going beyond just those metrics, right, of dollars raised and gifts closed, I'm encouraging candidates and I'm encouraging hiring managers to ask the questions about how many donors have increased their gifts. How many of your donors in a portfolio have joined committees or have become involved? Because that's showing that you're doing that good work of getting to know people. I've also been encouraging candidates to elaborate on their volunteer experiences, right? Your resume should give the whole outlook of who you are, what you care about, how you're involved in your community, because then that paints a little bit more of the picture. You know, yes, fundraisers have to bring in certain amount of dollars, but how are you also going to advance the mission of the organization that you're serving? How are you going to deeply connect with the cause that you're raising money for. And that's where I think you get to look at the whole picture of someone. And that's where the connection really sticks, right? That's what I talk about. For me, what I love about executive search, it's everything that I loved about major gift fundraising. Because when you find that spark of a donor connecting with an organization, and you have to work really hard to keep that donor, right, engaged as a donor so they don't just move on to another organization. It's kind of the same thing, right? When you hire people who care deeply about the mission, what are you doing to make sure that they are loving the organization as much on, you know, year three or four as they did on day one? So I think it's really looking at the whole person, right? And I think sometimes we've told candidates like, oh, you have to just talk about your job, talk about these metrics. But now I think we're going to be going a little bit beyond. Again, maybe that's a good outcome of the pandemic, that we that our curiosity about who people are, people bringing more of their full selves to their work.
Yeah. So I'm interested to see if you and I would be on the same page on this. If you and I were advising a client, they got two candidates to pick from. One is a younger individual who's raised half as much money as the other person, but they're clearly a demonstrated what we would generally in this space call a curious chameleon. The other candidate is 10 years older, spouts off not, you know, right and left about the seven-figure gifts that he or she has secured. I'm always going to be betting on that younger curious chameleon.
Yeah. I had that situation during my tenure at Lindauer, and there was someone who walked into the room and lit up the room and wore a tie that was the school colors and just had this, like, was already like a brand ambassador. And the other candidate who had several years over them was, you know, doing the same, right? Talking about, you know, this is how I do things, you know, and was super, super qualified. But they wound up hiring the person with less experience because they were a greater fit, right? There was a little bit more, I think, of the curiosity. I think of the, like, flexibility, that hunger, that enthusiasm. And I think that it's also for organizations and hiring managers have to understand, who are you, right? What's the pace of your shop? What's the culture of your organization? What's the personality of your organization, right? Who do you need? I recently read an article on LinkedIn, and it said there's two types of fundraisers, hunters and farmers, right? You probably heard the same thing, right? The hunter is like, oh, I'm going to go out and get the meat and bring the meat home, and it's going to be a great kill, right? And they come home and it's great, and, you know, and you've got that, you know, that donor. But the farmers take their time. And they sow the seeds and they water and they watch things grow. But you're going to have the same result. Different organizations at different phases of their evolution need different characteristics. When I was building my team at JF&CS, I needed the hunters. I needed people who were going to go out there and connect with donors who had never been spoken with before, to thank them for their support, to hear their story, to renew their gift and ask for increased gifts and to engage with them. I didn't have the time to do research, to let the seeds grow. We had to get out there and do a lot of things at the same time. I made some hiring mistakes because I didn't understand my pace. And I hired someone who worked at a slower pace. They had raised great dollars at a much larger institution, but I needed someone to work a bit faster. So I think all of this comes back to doing the work as hiring managers and as an organization and working with consultants like you and your team to understand, who are we? You have to know who you are before you're going to, you know, engage in successful hiring, especially in building teams.
So I saw your post about the farmers and the farmers and the hunters. And it reminded me, Wendy, when I read that, it reminded me, John Hagel, in the Silicon Valley, has recently published a book that's based on some research that his team had done, I think, about a decade ago. In a section of the book, he basically talks about what's called the passion of the explorer. And I think this is one of the things that we haven't developed an appreciation for sufficiently in fundraising as it relates to hiring talent. And one of the characteristics, so they basically figured out, they kind of narrowed down sort of the moving employed population in this study down to about 14% of the people that are out there have what they call the passion of the explorer. And the argument that Hegel is making is that these people are particularly suited for sort of where our 21st century workplace and all the competitive challenges and sort of dynamics that we're competing with and da-da-da-da. But I think the interesting thing that Hegel says that's particularly applicable to fundraising is that he says that these individuals, one of the key characteristics about these individuals is that they have a staunch commitment to the domain with which they're in. They're committed to, and in the case of fundraising, that would mean that their identity, their professional identities, are willingly rooted in fundraising. And I go back to the example of the younger rising star who perhaps demonstrates this, like the two characters we were just talking about a few moments ago. That younger person, oftentimes in my mind, not younger, we'll say less experienced. The less experienced individual oftentimes has the passion of the explorer. That older, more experienced person, oftentimes in my case, I find hinges on professional expertise they developed in other places like sales, PR, marketing, and other places. And so their commitment is, their passion is not rooted in that particular domain. Do you follow what I'm saying or what he's saying?
I do. You know, I think it's
like, I want people to come in and fall in love with fundraising. So I'm not saying they can't come from those places. I'm not saying they can't come from those places, but when I read what Hegel's talking about, I'm like, okay, once you're in this fundraising role, I don't want you to I totally get, for example, these folks who are constantly saying fundraising is like sales, but that also suggests your heart's not in fundraising. I want to know what's different, not always know what's similar. Right. Does that make sense?
It totally does. And, you know, I don't think fundraising is like sales, right? Donors give from a different lens, from a different part of their brain than sales, right? It is about that emotional connection. It's about a legacy, right? When you think about a donor who includes an organization in their estate plan, it's like the organization is part of their family, right? So the best fundraisers are people who are deeply connected to and committed to people and to causes. We were just invited to participate in a call with a group of young rising stars. Someone has put this group together, and these were rock stars. I mean, they're all in their early 30s. What was very surprising to me, Jason, is many of them had advanced degrees, not just masters, MBAs, PhDs. These people are practitioners and students. That did not exist 25 years ago. You know, I think that what we've seen in fundraising over the past 30 years is literally the professionalization of the profession, right? I mean, I don't know, 30 years ago, there weren't that many books about fundraising. And so I think now, right, you can be a student of, you know, you can get a degree in nonprofit management. And so I think we're going to see a next generation of nonprofit leaders who have made a commitment, right, from a much earlier age than some people who have fallen into it, you know, who are, you know, learning and flying by the seat of our pants and learning on the job. And I think so much of what we learn is through our experiences. But I saw something really different with this group of millennial fundraisers and a different kind of commitment and seriousness to kind of learning the craft of development and learning, like, really learning the art and science of it. It was such a fascinating conversation. But I wonder if we're going to see more people taking an intentional path into the field of fundraising than just falling into it the way many of us did over the past few decades.
That's totally affirming. And I think we were having that. So with my previous book, Wendy, we talked a lot about what you just said. It was the idea that sort of, and I haven't talked about that in probably 100 episodes, if not more, The more senior among us oftentimes describe their professional path into fundraising through the back door. And so it sort of comes with this sort of this inferiority, insecurity, inadequacy sort of things. Like it lacks this level of intentionality. And I'm right there with you, Wendy. You talk to some of these generally younger fundraisers and, like, right out the gate, I think about one of my earliest podcast guests. She's leading a team of 40 fundraisers over at CHOP in Philadelphia. She like right out of college, she's probably not 40 years old this year. She's leading a team of 40 individual fundraisers at the, you know, big healthcare facility in Philadelphia. She's remarkable, but she identifies herself as a fundraiser first and foremost. She doesn't allude to the idea that she came through the back door. She has no insecurities about the type of work that she's doing.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I think higher ed probably led the way, right? But I think that, and I think maybe healthcare came next. And then you look at the .orgs, right? All of the social service agencies, right? Where many of the people leading development started off as volunteers, right? And so I think the sector as a whole is catching up. You know, when you look at CASE, which has been around for so long and has, you know, always had these incredible conferences, you don't see as much of that in other sectors. And so I think that I feel a responsibility as someone who's been in the field, you know, for a long time. And really, I view myself, I am a fundraiser through and through. I'm committed to the nonprofit sector. I feel such an obligation to be paying it forward, to be a mentor, because I am only where I am because so many people took an interest in me and in mentoring me. I think the next generation of nonprofit leaders will have to have those mentors, but they're doing a lot of other kind of learning that is so much more formal. And it's just going to be fascinating, you know, to see that trajectory.
So when I'm usually saying I've written this, I've said this on the podcast, and I've said this to clients, I said, oftentimes when you're hiring these younger fundraisers, this sort of millennial generation of young fundraisers, taking it very intentionally. I just said this to a client in Denver that I was working with before the holiday, 6 months ago, wrapped up with them 6 months ago. I said, you're going to hire somebody who's perfectly qualified for this job. They're going to be, in many cases, they're going to need to be compensated in order to be competitive with the other jobs that they're qualified for, same jobs, other institutions nearby. They're going to perhaps be some of the, you know, right there in the senior leadership levels of all of your compensation, but they're generally going to be 10 years younger than the people for whom you're paying those same salaries inside your organization. Does that make sense to you?
Well, it does. And one thing that is changing rapidly is transparency around salaries. And many job sites are starting to require salaries are posted. And I don't think that's going to be as much a challenge within the fundraising field, but it will be a challenge for people in organizations who are working in other departments, where you have division directors, where you have program directors who maybe are at a higher level in the organization's hierarchy, but are making less money than a frontline fundraiser, right?
Yeah. So that's exact with my last employer. So in my last employer, I think I might have just recently turned 30 years old, coming out of a major gifts role in Washington, moving to a more, a smaller metro area. I came on the scene at probably just around 30 years old. And the much more senior to me, another member of a leadership team, was probably 15 to 20 years older than I was, but I was making $10,000 more a year than he was. And I mean, he got himself totally tied up in knots. And all these people were basically paying me was slightly more than I was making when I was in Washington, D.C. And I mean, he got himself totally tied up in knots. I'm guessing that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard, right? Because you can argue, right? These are revenue producing positions, right? It's not saying that people are it's different kind of work, right? You can't change the whole system. But in order to achieve the kind of equity that is really needed in the field and in every industry, right? Salary transparency is really big. I mean, look, you can look up any nonprofit's 990 and you can see the top five highest paid employees. And it was really interesting because of several years ago, the CFO came into my office and said, you know, your senior major gift officer is going to be in the top five. Like, she needs to know that because people might say things to her. And she was bringing in millions of dollars and she was absolutely earning every penny. but so was everyone else throughout the agency. And so I think it's a little bit more of like a reckoning, an institutional culture, because you can't all of a sudden say, okay, with all of these .orgs, nonprofits, I'm just using as an example, where there is such a discrepancy between the salary of a gift officer and the salary of a program director. It's a really big challenge.
It's essentially what we're talking about. We'll wrap up on this thought, but I think it's sort of what we're getting at here. When you're hiring, a lot of these organizations, especially smaller nonprofit organizations, they have generally hired leadership level roles on the more programmatic side and administrative side, which generally speaking, for a smaller nonprofit organization, all of those compensation levels can be relatively consistent across the board. And generally, you can find talent in a lot of those areas that are generally, they sort of all fit in the same box, if you will. But is basically what we're talking about, Wendy, that when you enter into the fundraising space, and I find this with a lot of the private schools, you know, thriving sort of private schools that are growing and they're hiring their first chief development officer, chief advancement officer for the first time, they're now starting to hire sort of outside, they're hiring inside of a market, and it's a they don't understand that there's a market for fundraising talent in the same way that there's a market for everybody else that they've hired. And so they're not competing with the other private school down the street. They're literally competing in many cases. I'm saying to my clients, for example, I'm working with a client in Georgia right now, and they've got universities all around them. I mean, tons of universities within, you know, a 50 square mile area. And I'm like, you're not competing with those two other private schools in town. You're competing with those other 12 major universities mm-hmm. and systems of higher education, not to mention healthcare in the area.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about salary discrepancy within organizations, but then when you talk about salary discrepancy across the nonprofit sector, right, where if you work in healthcare yeah. or higher education, you're going to get paid top dollar. And then you look at some of the more yeah. exclusive private schools. But then when you get to the cultural institutions or the environmental institutions or museums, I mean, you can have a chief development officer who's making the same salary as a gift officer down the street, to your point, at a hospital, right? There's so much discrepancy across the field. And I think it does make it really hard, right? I think that one of the things that we're talking about with our clients is just because you're a university or a hospital doesn't mean you can only hire someone who's worked in higher education or healthcare. A good fundraiser is a good fundraiser if they, you know, connect with the mission. But if you are a museum and you really want someone who's learned great skills as a fundraiser in healthcare or higher education, they're not going to work for you for, you know, under $120,000, or maybe that's, you know, maybe it's under $150,000. That might be what they're paying their chief development officer. And of course, geography is making a big difference too. And now when we talk about borderless talent, right, if you are down in the South, right, and you're saying you don't have to show up for to come to the office, now you're looking, wow, maybe I can hire some great fundraisers who are in major metropolitan areas working for some top institutions. They're not going to come to your shop and get paid, you know, some salaries in the South that are far lower, and they're still paying their New York City rents, right? So I think this salary, I mean, we could talk like for days about, you know, compensation yes. and salary within the sector and across organizations. And the transparency is going to have a really interesting impact. And it'll be interesting, you know, maybe we talk about this like a year from now to think like, well, what happened now that all these salaries were being posted? How have things changed? Because they're just going to have to, right? And I think it's also going to have to tell boards and finance committees, right, how they're thinking about their investment in their personnel, right? And coming back to retention, right? If you want to keep people, it is less expensive to keep people than to have that turnover, right, at all levels across organizations. And so how do you think about putting that investment into your people so that they stay? And maybe you have to toss a program director another $5,000, $10,000. But if they leave, you're going to be paying a whole lot more money.
So, Wendy, I like to advocate for people who are okay with challenging the status quo. And I know you're an established firm, but what you guys, your particular division, as you were explaining to me before we hit the record button, has sort of been startup mode. So tell me, as we sort of wrap up, there's probably a handful of people who might be inclined to reach out to you. How are you sort of challenging the status quo, and who is it that you want to hear from?
Absolutely. So we are a boutique firm that is part of a global organization. Every search that we lead and every search in Boyden around the world is led by partners. There is not layers of who our clients work with. They know exactly who they're working with. We have weekly communications with our clients, and we are completely transparent with where we are in the process. For candidates, we want to get to know you. We are not just going to be talking to you about one search and you'll never hear from us again. We want to be partners with you in your career journey. And I think with our clients, we want to be your brand ambassadors. We take that really seriously, that we are an extension of your teams. And those are some of the values that is across Boyden. One of the things that we're excited to bring to our clients is our cross-sector expertise. And so perhaps we're working on a search for a CEO of a nonprofit, and maybe the nonprofit is looking for someone who has a different skill set, maybe someone who's worked in the for-profit sector and has a deep connection to the mission. Our colleagues around the country will know those talented professionals. So we believe that we're bringing something a little bit different. But again, I think as we talked about, my role as a frontline fundraiser gives me those skills and that deep commitment to cultivation and stewardship and trust and transparency. And that's what we're bringing to our clients and to our candidates. If you are a hiring manager, if you're thinking about building your team, call us. We'd love to talk with you. If you are at any stage in your career and you're thinking about what you're going to do next in your career, we'd love to talk with you as well.
Wendy, if somebody does want to reach out to you, is there a website you want to send them to? You want to give them your email address? Give us some information on how they, we'll put some information about you in the show notes, but how do you want them to reach out to
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. wwilsker@boyden.com is my email address. Boyden.com is our website. I am also very active on LinkedIn. I try to post about 3 days a week myself, my business partner, Lisa Vona. If you comment or share or message us, we will respond to you. You will get a response within 24 hours. We want to hear from people. We want to be part of this conversation. It's a really exciting time for nonprofits. It's a transformational time. And we want to be really in it with our colleagues across the country.
Wendy, I can keep you going. I've much enjoyed this conversation. We lose our listeners in about 45 minutes, so we've landed the plane right about the right time. Thank you again. You're always welcome back.
Thanks so much. It was great to talk with you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.